Dr. Ivan Van Sertima, 1935 to 2009, is the author-editor of more than 15 books and seminal publications under the title of The Journal of African Civilization. Throughout his career, Dr. Ivan Van Sertima sought to change the way that African people throughout the world saw themselves and understood their rightful place in history. His many titles included They Came Before Columbus, Black Women in Antiquity, The African Presence in Early Europe, Blacks in Science, Sheikh Anta Diop, The Golden Age of the Moors, and Egypt Revisited. Dr. Van Sertima worked with the most accomplished African writers and thinkers of the last several generations. He collaborated with Dr. Asa Hilliard, Dr. Renoko Rashidi, Professor Maynou Mpim, Dr. Charles Finch, Professor Beatrice Lumpkin, Sonia Sanchez, Edward Scobie, John G. Jackson, Wayne Chandler, and many others. In the following interview with KPFA programmers Barry Scott and Paris Williams, Dr. Van Sertima discusses the early African presence in the Americas.
You left Guyana when you were 14?
No. I left the jungle when I was 14. I left Guyana when I was 24.
And you went to the London...
Yes, off I went to England, not immediately to London University, because I had to work in England for 5 years before I could get a scholarship to the university.
What was your experience at the university like?
Well, this is one of the most depressing experiences of my life. I had hoped when I had got very interested in Africa through its literature, not its anthropology. The anthropology of Africa, 90 to 95% of it is extremely depressing because it deals almost exclusively with primitives on the edge and periphery of African civilizations. What drew me into study of Africa was its literature, the work of Amos Chuchola, Chinua Achebe, the great West African and great East African writers like Ngugi, etc. These are the people who drew me into Africa. And I had hoped in the university that I would learn more about that sophisticated center or nucleus of African civilizations. Not so at all. I learned almost nothing about African civilizations in the university. I learned about localized cultures, little cocoon cultures with their rituals and their dialects and their and all sorts of things, their kinship charts, who is one's mother's brother's sister's son, irrelevant things, things that may have had some significance for the study and development of anthropology in the early years, but which became an insult, very humiliating, very humiliating. All of one's searchings for what lay at the core of Africa, the quintessential Africa, and all of these things were thwarted in the university.
And this is what you said characterizes your experience at the London School of Oriental African Studies?
Yes, I must point that out. The London School of Oriental and African Studies is touted as the best school in the world for African studies. If one's conception of the African is of a primitive or a low-level, non-technological creature on the edge of the world, then that is the best school to study.
What took you? What out of that mode?
In a strange way, that did not happen suddenly. That did not happen suddenly. One of the things that saved me, there were two events. One that I had tried to suppress totally. My father was a rebel. He and his party, the National Movement, which was then known as the PPP, had won seats in the parliament. This was the first democratic election or near democratic election in the colonial world of Guyana. And we won these seats. And then, to our astonishment, just about 4 months after that, the British threw away our constitution, put most of my friends, most of our leaders into prison, took away the ministries from us, and they just put into power those people who had opposed us, who had hardly won any votes. And they did this for 4 years. That had a profound impression on me, but strangely enough, Instead of making me more revolutionary, it made me very scared, because I began to realize that we were sitting in the mouth of a lion, and that if we made any trouble, we could easily be snapped, our heads could be snapped off. So that it had a strange countering effect. It made me very quiet. I pulled back. All my revolutionary fervor went back inside. I wrote a poem at that time, about 4 years afterwards, when I felt like if I was a sleeping volcano. And that poem, in fact, was translated into many languages, in German, in Russian, in French. That is the poem I became more famous famous by, called Volcano. And I remember some of the lines of that poem, because they spoke so much of the kind of slumbering fire inside of me. And that fire did not spark again until I got into Africa. The fury of being sent out to do some humiliating task, to gather word lists of legal terms in Swahili, because I was studying Bantu linguistics and anthropology in London. But it was the Bantu linguistics that really led me, not the anthropology. It was the language that led me into a discovery about Africa, which startled me, which started to break up things inside of me. Because when I was in Africa, in Tanzania, I began to realize that many of the things I had been taught and told were not true. In very minor things, you know, dealing with legal systems and the way the language was used, the way the people thought and felt, how they behaved, all of these things were in such contradiction. What I was learning in the field were contradicting what I had learned in books. That began a certain shift in me, but that did not have immediate effects. It had immediate effects in the sense that my brain exploded. I began to do things with a greater energy and power than before. I'll never forget that. My visit to Africa, in the part where I lived, I didn't go out searching for Africa as a problem. I did not go out in order to be blasted into a state of absolute hopelessness. Some people do that when they go to Africa. They want to find the worst part of Africa so that all their hopes could be blasted to death. Fortunately, that is not what happened to me. I began to be fed by incredible energies. Never before in my life did I feel like a lighted bulb, as if something had been turned on inside of me. I felt as if I had picked up some cord, some strange umbilical cord, and that I had put this electric cord, I had plugged it into the wall, and some ancient electricity coming from the past had begun to enter like a great current into my soul. I found an explosion of my brain, a real explosion occurred. I could work for 10 hours. I did the Swahili Dictionary of Legal Terms, which was thought impossible. I did that in a few months, and there were legal and linguistic teams that had been working for years who couldn't do it because of the different eye and vision that they had on Africa. And I think that was a turning point, because although returning to England and the tremendous opposition towards me, I was nearly expelled from the university because of my impetuousness, because I was considered to be so arrogant. I became very arrogant when I realized how stupid my teachers were. When I realized that my professors were, although they were world authorities, they were basically very limited people. I mean, I think that is what led me. This was to slowly lead me out of that kind of world.
Can you give some examples? When you mentioned earlier about the difference between what you are taught and what you observe, can you give some examples of what that would be?
For example, one of the things I was very surprised to find is that research was not as objective as I thought it was. I always thought that people were scientifically objective when they were doing research. I found that prejudices had a profound impact on what you were doing. Like, I was in Tanzania, in Dar es Salaam, in the city of Dar es Salaam, and there were some of these people making up wordless legal terms, and they were actually making it up. They had been hired, or the Tanzanian government had hoped that they would explore, some people like ourselves would explore how language was being used. The Swahili was being used in the legal courts, because they were only using it in the lower courts. In the higher courts, they were using English, and they wanted to push English aside as the major language of the law. And here were these English people making up terms for the Swahili, rather than finding out what lay among the native. What was the resources of that native language? They were contemptuously dismissing the native. I discovered documents going back before the British times, and through those documents I could find a way to really find what was native to that world, what legal resources lay in that language. Now, those are the things that made me realize that in most of the books I had read about Africa, people were merely planting onto those works their own ideas, their own assumptions, their own prejudices, their own reflexes, so that we were not seeing the African world at all. That is when I began to realize, too, that people were always dealing with edges and periphery of the African world. They were always moving away from the quintessential, what lay at the center and core of African civilization. I think that realization was the most revolutionary realization in my life. The realization that people were always looking on the edge of things, rather at the center of things, particularly in African studies.
You've made reference to the quintessential,
yes.
Quintessential African reality. What is that?
Well, by this I mean you can dwell. You see, reality is a very complex thing. I mean, I could sit in this studio. This studio is particularly quiet because it is a studio. But actually, I can hear, because of my training in the jungle, I could hear the whisper of the electric light. I could hear the whisper of current in the electric light. I'm aware also of other kinds of songs, very subtle, thin songs coming into this room. Now, I need to concentrate on my voice. I need to concentrate on what you're saying. Therefore, reality becomes focus. Okay, reality is not merely opening yourself totally to everything that is happening because you become confused. Reality, therefore, involves focus. If, therefore, you want to focus on the worst aspects of something, if you want to focus on what is irrelevant or peripheral, you could do so. When people are dealing with Africans, the contempt is so great that they always focus on the worst aspects. You don't see any pictures on television about African cities. Have you ever seen that?
No.
Have you seen any great pictures of African parliaments? No.
No.
Whenever you see pictures of Africa, it's always somebody starving, somebody with disease. Okay. So that you see that, you think that is reality because the camera is there, the camera doesn't lie. But that's not reality. That is a distorted focus. So the whole world begins to be created by that focus. Okay, that is why you get these extraordinary distortions. When people deal with Europe, they deal with the quintessential European. They don't deal with the barbaric edges of Europe. And I know, I've lived in Europe, both Eastern and Western Europe. I've lived in villages in Europe where as many as 30 Europeans share one bathroom. Nobody focuses in on that peripheral reality of Europe. They focus in on Greco-Roman civilization. They focus in on the cities. They focus in on the great music of Europe. They focus in on the genius of Europe. Okay, that is what one means by quintessential, the golden thread of European civilization. When you try to do that with Africans or Native Americans, people say you're being romantic. They think reality is going to the worst possible, the lowest common denominator. This is what one means by the quintessential thread of African civilizations.
One of the things that you had said is that one of the reasons why you put the Blacks in Science book together was that in your travels and efforts to try to get people to understand the fact that African presence in America, but, you know, in other parts of the world, that people could not even understand or had no knowledge of the fact of the kinds of capabilities and the kinds of kingdoms that would even make it even possible for an African people to be able to travel to the Americas or even have the kinds of technologies available to make any of that happen. So what I thought that we could do is to more or less talk about very briefly the kind of science, the kind of technology, the kinds of kingdoms that existed in Africa that would make this kind of travels and this kind of influences even possible and even still felt now.
Yes, this is an extremely exciting field. The discovery that Africans were involved in extremely complex technologies long before the invasions by Europeans. As you point out, Barry, this is one of the things that this looking at the edge or periphery of Africa made it difficult for people to discover those technologies. Now they have found, just within the past few years, they have found African smelting steel in Tanzania in a machine that achieved a temperature of 1,850 degrees centigrade. No machine ever achieved that level, that kind of temperature. The highest ever achieved in Europe before the 19th century was 1,620 degrees. They found, too, that Africans were doing this using less fuel. They found, too, that the Africans were doing this in a single stage, that they were forming steel through iron crystallization, which is a semiconductor technology unknown until the 20th century. And they were doing this 1,500 years ago. And that's a conservative estimate. Some people push it back to 2,000 years. They found African astronomical observatories, such as one in Kenya 300 years before Christ. They found Africans creating the world's first intelligent and accurate calendar, the Sothic calendar, which bears on Sirius A. They found also West Africans plotting Sirius B, which is impossible to see with the naked eye, not only showing its orbit and trajectory up to the end of the 20th century, but showing things about its essential weight and mass, which is an incredibly advanced kind of astronomy. They showed its elliptical orbit of 50 years around its parent star, Sirius A, and its orbit of 1 year on its own axis. They indicated contraction and expansion of a celestial body close to Sirius B. Only 2 years ago, the Einstein orbiting satellite established Africans were dead correct. And the Africans were doing this centuries ago in medieval Mali. They found the Africans involved in pioneering medical operations which were experimental in Europe. They found Africans highly advanced in the cesarean section, which is a very difficult operation, the cutting of the abdominal cavity. They observed this, the way they stitched. They observed Africans were using anesthetics and antiseptics in their operating theaters at a time when Europe would only introduce antiseptics in one part of Europe, listed introduced antiseptics 2 years earlier. They found Africans at that time were doing this fairly routinely, indicating they were doing it at least half a century before. In the time they found the cesarean section in Africa being performed with routine skill, the European operation was so experimental that the woman invariably died. They found Africans using aspirin before the modern world. They were using Salix capensis, which yields salicylic acid, the main active ingredient in aspirin. They found Africans who were using tetracycline, which is a major antibiotic. 14 centuries ago, they found it in their bones. It is only in the 1950s we began using tetracycline. They found Africans pioneering in eye cataract surgery in the 13th century. They found Africans pioneering in brain surgery, the cutting and drilling of holes in the skull where the plaques of bone grew back, 85% success in the operation. They found Africans pioneering in the use of things like physostigmine, which, by the way, was synthesized by a black scientist in this country. It treats glaucoma and various other eye diseases. They found Africans pioneering in the use of drugs to treat hypertension and psychotic disorder. One of their medicines became major in Europe. All of these things are only found within the past few years. In medicine, in mathematics, the earliest documents in the world in mathematics are African. They found Africans not only made tremendous advances in geometry, in fact, created geometry along the Nile Valley, but that they made major advances in trigonometry, major advances in algebra, which was later refined even more by the Arabs as they invaded Africa. You have all of these things being found only within a short time, and found because of what I'm saying. A different eye, a different way of looking at the world, instead of concentrating on peripheral primitives, looking at what lay at the center and core of African civilization, searching for what is quintessential, because that is how we connect significantly with Africa. If we think Africa is just a lot of starving people in Ethiopia, which is one aspect of reality, or just a lot of low technology people on the edge of the world, which has been done through the colonization process, which has halted technological progress in Africa. If we become overwhelmed and oppressed by those images, those partial aspects of reality, then we do not want to associate with Africa. We cannot significantly plug into an Africa that we can transform and which can transform us. Okay, it's very important to understand this doesn't only affect research, it also affects the capacity to relate in such a way to Africa that it begins to be a redeeming feature, something that galvanizes us, that fills us with a new energy and power and hope that can have value not only to the American but also to the African as well.
Let's talk about, because there's so much to cover, let's talk about some of the, well, let me just back up. I think on one level or another, even if it's incorrect knowledge, many of us have learned about the grandeur of the Egyptian dynasties. But what about some of the other kingdoms, such as in Ghana or in Mali?
Yes, well, the one in Mali is the one that has excited me most. And I think you should know why, Barry, because Ghana was extraordinary. But after its fall, Ghana was so powerful that no European power could have attacked Africa at that time successfully, not West Africa. That's one of the things many people ask. But if Africa had produced so many wonderful things, why did it fall? Why was it so easily crushed? It was not easily crushed. And the reason why, however, great inroads were made into Africa is that Africa was in a state of vulnerable transition at the time it was attacked. Okay? Because you see, if it were attacked during the Ghanaian Empire, the ancient Ghanaian Empire, the Ghanaians could throw 200,000 men into the field at the time when 10,000 men defeated England. But after the fall of Ghana, you have Mali. If Europe had attacked West Africa during the Mali Empire, there is no way a European army could have succeeded. No way. Even at the height of Songhai, which succeeded Mali, there was no major attack from Europe. The attack occurred when, as happens in all worlds, in whether African, Asiatic, European, there was a vulnerable transitional period between empires. The Songhai Empire was cracking up. All empires crack up at some point. The Africans were extremely lucky in Egypt because that lasted for 3,000 years. But even so, over those 3,000 years, there were periods of extreme vulnerability between the passage of great kingdoms, okay? So that you do not have a centralized empire in Africa at the time of the attacks, the major last phase of attacks. I'm not talking about the attack on Egypt, but the attack on West Africa. We did not have it together at the time, and that's not our fault, because there are always periods in history, regardless of where you are, where you don't have it together, where you're passing through a phase before you enter another major centralized empire. So that we couldn't throw large armies in the field, we couldn't act as a united force in a great part of Africa. We have to see both internal and external things that accounted for our weakness at the time. So you have to understand there's a whole body of things that are responsible for that kind of defeat. It had nothing to do just simply with superior armor or superior intelligence. Because take the things that defeated us most, gunpowder, artillery. Europeans didn't invent gunpowder. It's the Arabs who, entering China, took gunpowder out of Turkestan. The Egyptians had gunpowder too. They were not using it to destroy people. They were using gunpowder. The priests were using gunpowder in Egypt. They found out the Africans had gunpowder. West Africans had gunpowder before Europe. They were making gunpowder out of something, the kola nut. They had a Nigerian geophysicist has recently informed me of that. So that it wasn't an absence of gunpowder. The Europeans didn't invent artillery. The Russians have recently shown that the Arabs had artillery which they were using in India. All those secrets were to come into Europe as the Arabs and Africans advanced into Europe during the Moorish invasion. So that even the things that were to defeat us didn't come out of European intelligence. Even the ships that Columbus used and Vespucci to cross the oceans didn't come out of European intelligence. The sails were Arab-Latin sails. They were not European sails. The compass was not European. The astrolabe is not European. So with all this assumption that European superior technology, which to a vast extent is borrowing as other peoples moved into Europe, other peoples took things into Europe, this assumption that superior technology or superior intelligence that produced that technology defeated us, that is false. There are three main pieces of evidence, physical evidence, that establish beyond a shadow of a doubt that Africans were here in America. I want to deal specifically with one peer, their presence in America before Christ. We have found in what is the first formative civilization in America known as Olmec, we have found more than a dozen stone heads. We now found at least 14. Last year, March, on the cover of a magazine in Mexico, appeared a new head they found in the swamps. They haven't even dug it up yet. It is the most African of the heads. It's staring at them up from the swamps. They haven't even pulled it out of the ground. These heads are 6 to 9 feet high. They weigh from 10 to 40 tons. They not only have African features, two of them have African hair, clearly carved out. You could see on one at the back of one of them, the first one found at Tresopotes, you could see Ethiopian braids carved out at the back of the head. So it's not just the features now, but also hair. You find terracottas, many, many terracottas, many clay sculptures with African type features, African coloration which can be produced in clay or evoked in the clay, and African type hair and beards, etc. And they have found skulls. Professor Wierzynski, a Polish skull expert, has found in the dry areas of the Olmec civilization at Tlatelolco, at Cerro de las Misas, and at Monte Alban, skulls and extended skeletal material indicating an Africoid element, quite distinct from that of the Native American. Okay, in addition to that, there are many cultural influences. I can't go into that in 5 minutes, but there are many cultural influences we found in technology. The Americans, for the first time, building pyramids, both step and conical pyramid, appears on the very same platform where four of the heads, stone heads, were found, which were dated according to the wood of that platform. It dated 814 plus or minus 134 BC, that is between 948 and 680 years before Christ. We have found the Native Americans at El Viejon using paper made from wood pulp. Nobody in the world was making paper from wood pulp, and we haven't found any evidence of a wood pulp industry here at that time. Only the Egyptians were making paper from wood pulp and from papyrus, but from wood pulp as well, okay, which is unique. We have found other technological things. As I say, the techniques they used to move the great stone heads is the same as in Egypt. We find scripts. Egyptian scripts have been found in America. Dr. Barryfell and the Epigraphic Society have shown beyond a shadow of a doubt that in parts of America, there is one particular, the Davenport Stela in Iowa. They have found the Egyptian script next to the Libyan script, next to the Iberian Punic, which is Phoenician people involved with blacks both in the east and the west of the Mediterranean. They have found it instructing you how to regulate the calendar. And these, nobody could have forged that because nobody knew either Iberian Punic or Libyan at the time this was found in 1876. And we found Egyptian hieroglyphs with the same sound and meaning and form being used among the Mi'kmaq Indians, a branch of the Algonquians occupying the East Coast. And this brings me to a point which you have to bear in mind. This doesn't just happen in so-called Latin America, okay? It has nothing to do with Latin America. It has to do with America, North and South. Mexico was the center of an American civilization. It is not the shrunken Mexico of today. It was Mexico when it contained parts of California, parts of Texas, parts of Colorado, going right up to parts of Canada. So you're not really dealing simply with what people like to call Middle America or Latin America. You're dealing with the United States as well. In fact, the Egyptian scripts are found in the so-called United States. There was no United States, okay? The United States is just a few years old. Okay, that wasn't called United States. Mexico is in the United States because Mexico included parts of the United States. So don't get stuck into this idea that we're dealing with Central America and South. We are dealing with America. Okay, the evidence goes right through America. It doesn't just get stuck into the Gulf of Mexico. That's where the center of the civilization was, but that's not where it was localized.
Okay. What would bring Africans to America? And you're talking about
okay.
25th dynasty.
All right, first
Egyptians.
Of all, yes, not just the 25th dynasty, because I have found on later research that the 25th dynasty only begins around 800 BC, but from 1085 BC right through to the 25th dynasty, you have Nubian military as the power brokers and in control in the so-called Libyan dynasties, okay? The reason why people came to America, it was an accident initially. All so-called contacts with America are initially accidents. Columbus had no intention of coming here. He was going to India. He struck out for the latitude to Japan, and he thought he had landed in India. That's why this place was called India. It wasn't called America. It was called India. That's why the Native Americans are still being called Indians. Also, you find with Cabral, Alvarez Cabral, the Portuguese explorer, had no intention of coming here. He was off Africa. Storm came up and blew him to America. Okay, so you have to bear that in mind. Initially, these are accidents. The question arises, therefore, why were the Egyptian ships or Nubian ships and Phoenicians, why were they in the Atlantic at all? Because once you're in the Atlantic, such an accident could happen because there are three major currents that move ships, driftwood, anything. Once there's a storm and you're caught in the major currents off Africa, 100 miles off Africa, you're sucked to America. So it's not an intention. Some people believe it was intentional. Later it may have been intentional. Initially it was not intentional. The reason why you have a lot of shipping in the North Atlantic in this period covered by the carbon datings in America is because there was a war between Asia and Africa. The powers of Western Asia, the Assyrians, were attacking everybody in that Eastern Mediterranean. They captured the Jews. The blacks saved the Jews in 701 BC when the black troops entered Jerusalem and protected the Jews against the Asiatics. They attacked the Phoenicians. They had made vassals of the Phoenicians who were critical to black trade because the Phoenicians, both black-skinned Phoenicians as well as pale-skinned Phoenicians, were hired navigators in the Nubian-Egyptian navies. They had attacked the Hittites and smashed their empire, and they were moving on the Egyptians. Hence, all of the routes to the east were blocked. The Egyptians had sea routes going right through to Hawaii. We have found Egyptian scripts in Hawaii in this period. All of that was blocked off. That is why the commercial and military navies were forced west of the Mediterranean towards the Straits of Gibraltar and beyond. We even have entries of Ethiopian troops into Spain as early as this. We find Taharqa in 700 BC entering Spain with a garrison so that we have movements near the Atlantic. They're not just operating in Egypt, which is very far away from the Atlantic. We have troops and navies moving on the edge of the Mediterranean. We have tin mining in Cornwall in this period. We have evidence of blacks and Phoenicians in the Scilly Isles, which is only 25 miles from the tin mines of Cornwall around 800 BC. We have Phoenicians and blacks intermarrying around 800 BC in Carthage. So we have shipping in the North Atlantic. That is why we have clear evidence of the movement. Perhaps not initially intentional, later intentional. The reason why we know later it may have been intentional, because it could not just be one trip. We have found a map in Cairo, in the Sack Library of Alexandria, which was created by the Egyptians, which shows the exact latitudinal and longitudinal coordinates between the African coastline and the American coastline going up into the Gulf of Mexico towards Florida, picking up a large part of the Caribbean. That map indicates that before Christ, because it had to be drawn at that time, that map indicates a connection and a knowledge. And the types of ships on that map are the types of curved ships, like the papyrus reed boat and other ships of that period between 948 to 680 years before Christ.
Well, what you say they were in Cornwall, Were they mining tin in Cornwall?
Yeah, that's British Isles. Yes, that's in the North Atlantic, the British Isles. We have tin mining in Cornwall. Tin was very important. This was the last phase of the Bronze Age. Tin was very important because tin and copper was needed for the bronze armies of Egypt. Tin was found largely in... Copper was found in Cyprus. In fact, Cyprus is the word for copper. Okay, and tin was found in various places, but the tin mines were being exhausted in some places. So you find a further movement west of the Med searching for tin. And this is also the beginning of the Iron Age. So you may also have had searching for that, but you also have a searching for purple. Purple became absolutely vital to the Phoenician trade. Purple was as valuable as gold. Recently, a woman named Margaret Hanke has done a study of purple, showing that the Phoenicians, that's why it was known as Tyrian purple. Tyre was one of the Phoenician capitals. The Egyptians had made purple sacred. Only kings, bishops, popes, priests, things like that could use purple. Okay, purple, it was not a normal color. It was a special kind of dye. The Phoenicians exhausted all the sources of purple in the Mediterranean. And it is possible that they struck out to search for purple elsewhere. We have found cochineal, which is a source of purple. Murex is a source of purple in the Mediterranean. But cochineal is the source of purple in Mexico, at Oaxaca and various places. And we have found this cochineal, which is American. We have found it in some caves in North Africa. How the hell it got there without some trip going in here and coming back is a mystery. So that there maybe have been commercial reasons as well that led to later intentional voyages in the BC period. Because it's not only Egyptian, we have found Punic script, which is Phoenician. And we do have the mixing of Phoenicians with blacks, not only in the Ethiopian Egyptian in theater, but we also have that in Carthage in this period. Okay, one of the things that I have not yet touched on is ritual parallels. We have found several Egyptian gods turning up in Mexico. The god Sokar, for example. Obviously, they would not have the same names. But we find, for example, there is Sokar. He is standing on the back of a snake. This snake has a human head. It's not an ordinary snake. A man standing on a snake is nothing. But he's standing on a snake that has a human head. In fact, it has two heads, a head at the tail and a human head where the head should be. And he has his arms outstretched and there are wings coming out of his arms. We go to Mexico and we find in the Olmec world, we have a man standing there with wings coming out of his arms, and he's on the back of a snake with a human head. Okay? We find other rituals like opening the mouth of the dead ceremony, where in Egypt we have a priest standing with a sort of leopard or panther skin over him, the tail between his legs. In one hand he has a snake-headed stick. In the other hand, he has a peculiar instrument for which we have no name. And there's a guy kneeling or sitting beside him with a little tufted beard and a hat. We go to Mexico, and there is a priest-king standing with a leopard skin over him, tail between his legs, holding a snake-headed stick in one hand, and this peculiar instrument in the other. And there is this guy kneeling or sitting with a little tufted beard and the same kind of hat on his head. We have parallels like that. We have the god Aken, which is a rope-swallowing god. He barely has a face. His face is very featureless. And he's swallowing two ropes. You go to Mexico and there is the guy again swallowing two ropes. Now these are so arbitrary. While it is true that a civilization or a culture may have independent, it may throw up independently certain basic things like fish hooks, sandals, etc. These are so basic and simple things that if you find it in one civilization, find it in another, there's no evidence of influence. But when something is very arbitrary, like in Mexico, you would hear people, you would see them saying that is the ram. They're looking up in the sky and they say, well, that is the ram and that is the snake. This is a circular snake swallowing its own head. That's not in the sky. The Egyptians have arbitrarily placed that in the sky. And the Mexicans are arbitrarily placing it in the same area of the sky. Why? That is what startles us. How could you have evidence of a physical contact, which we find with the skulls, with the stone heads, with the terracottas, and then you're finding also cultural parallels that have no right to exist because they don't exist anywhere else except where we have evidence of an influence. So that if they are simple things, it doesn't mean anything. And this is the reason why this subject was dismissed in the 19th century and the early part of the 20th century. That you have a lot of foolish people who, whenever they see something in America, they see something in Egypt, they automatically assume that if there is a contact, all these things came out of Africa into America. I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that Africans created American civilization. They certainly did not. There were Americans here long, long, long before. What I am saying is that they made contact during a most significant period, a formative period in American civilization, and that they had a profound influence on that civilization. And that we can show in a complex way, very intimate and complex parallels in those civilizations, so that even though the Olmec had their own thing going, new elements were brought in which they incorporated. Okay, the reason why this subject was not taken seriously before is not only due to prejudice, but you have a lot of ignorant people who want to claim that everything they find in point A is in point B. That's not true. Civilizations can independently throw up something. But when you find a whole series of things, take the Olmec priest kings. The Olmec priest kings, you find two of them wearing the double crown. Nobody on earth wears the double crown except Egyptian and Nubian. There's no reason. There's a political reason for that in Egypt because they had to join the two lands together. So nobody has a double crown in the world except Egyptian. The Olmec priest kings, two of them we have found with the double crown. Now, purple, again. Nowhere in the Mediterranean are people wearing purple except they're touched by the Phoenicians and the Egyptians. Here, the purple is an index of royalty just as in Egypt. Once again, the Egyptians have their priest kings or pharaohs. They have something known as feathered sunshades. It has three colors, three concentric circles. It's made of bird feathers. You go among the Olmec and you find the same thing, the three concentric circles, the same three colors. You find the Egyptians have the flail. This is something you hold. It falls over the shoulder. You have the crook. You go to the Olmec, they have the crook and they have the flail. All the elements, therefore, the major paraphernalia of royalty are being duplicated. If you have a cluster of interconnected parallels like that, having the same function, then you become aware that this is too complex, too arbitrary to be other than an influence. It ceases to be a coincidence because it is against all statistical probability for so many duplications to occur.
Let's skip a minute and go to the other major contact that I understand existed, and that was during the Mandingo Empire. And what influences or evidence to show that there was a later major contact in the Americas?
Yes, as I have said in my book, this was not a once and for all affair. The Atlantic did not suddenly close up. You have movements across the Atlantic at various periods, some accidental, some planned. We have evidence that somewhere around 1311, 1312, there were two voyages, one in which a king called Abu Bakari II, who was the brother of Kanka Musa, who became very famous for taking a vast number of Mandingo across the desert towards Cairo. We have his brother involved in sending out a navy, an African navy, using double canoes. Now, I want to say something about the so-called double canoe. Africans did not merely work with dugouts, okay? The Africans invented seven types of ships that I know of on the Niger, far more complex than the dugout. The dugout was just a basic building block. They invented many ships along the Nile, and they invented all the ships along the Indian Ocean. We have evidence that something, a double ship, a ship with two parts, one for food and provisions, etc., one for people, was sent across the Atlantic, about 200 of these ships, and they were sent across the Atlantic. When they did not return, a captain of this first fleet came back home and mentioned that there was a river in the middle of the sea, a smooth, fast-running body of water, which is the currents that I speak of, which took the ships forward. And he got frightened. He was at the back of the fleet, and he came home. Abu Bukhari II got excited, and he left the throne. He actually abdicated. He left Kanka Musa as a regent and got at the head of another fleet and went across the Western Ocean into these currents. Now, during that same period, we have a black-faced, black-bearded Quetzalcoatl entering Mexico, okay? Now, I want you to note, I'm not saying Quetzalcoatl is black. There are many Quetzalcoatls. It's not one Quetzalcoatl. Quetzalcoatl was known as the white god of civilization. He wasn't white in terms of skin because the Americans never used white for skin. They used white for cloth. A Muslim, a black Muslim, would be called a white figure. Okay, they used it for cloth. They used it for cloud. They used it for milk. They did not use it for skin because they would speak of pale skin. That is the word they use for white people, pale skin, when they first saw Europeans. In 1519, when Cortes came, that was the end of a specific cycle in which they expected a white-robed figure to come on the seas, because their Quetzalcoatl, who was a native Mexican, disappeared around 999 AD. And the 1312, when Abu Bakari appeared, as well as the 1519, when Cortes appeared, those were cycles of expectation, the end of cycles. Okay, the end of 52-year cycles in which they had a certain expectation. So you have both black-faced Quetzalcoatl. You have the Quetzalcoatl who was a white man who came in 1519, and they weren't sure whether he was a Quetzalcoatl or not. You have the native Quetzalcoatl. So that is what they have several. They call him Q. All right, let's call him Q for short. You have several Qs, okay, both native and foreign, both before Christ and after. What is the clinching piece of the evidence is that most of the linguistic evidence, which is first studied by Leo Wiener in the 1920s, most of that linguistic evidence links up with Mandingo words, Mandingo trade words in Mexico, certain garments that Mandingo were making have been found in South America, that like the almazar, certain plants that the Mandingo would have carried with them have turned up in parts of South America and parts of Mexico, particularly in South America. Certain words, and when I say words, not accidental words, I mean whole complexes. You know, whole complex, like in words in terms of the magicians of the Mandingo, the witch doctors and so forth. You have whole bodies of things like that, which are described in great detail in my book, because I summarize and simplify Wiener when I come to deal with the linguistic argument. What annoyed me about Wiener is that Wiener, although he was quite brilliant and far-reaching in his thought about these visits and had established a linguistic case, he didn't establish much else. He was unfortunate because he was born too early, and he did not have the advantage of the work that had been done after him. He did not even know, and this is one of his remarkable guesses he made, he did not even know about Abu Bakari II, yet he guessed from the linguistic evidence that this visit of the West Africans was made at the beginning of the 14th century. He was dead correct, although he did not know that Abu Bakari had actually made such a visit, and that we have evidence for it, not only in the oral tradition of the Mandingo, but in the documents in Cairo, because the governor of Cairo was told about this and recorded it when Abu Bakari II's brother came to Cairo on his pilgrimage.
Dr. Van Sertima, last night when you spoke at New College of California, one of the things that most impressed me that you said last night was when you talked about the colonization of the imagination. I was really deeply struck by that phrase, because as you were saying earlier, that reality very often is perspective and focus. Very often we find it difficult to conceive of things, or just to sit here and to listen to you. It just seems mind-boggling. I suppose the only thing I can say at this point is that you have participated incredibly in sort of breaking the bonds of that colonization for me and many other people.
Well, you see, I find that this business about colonization, the imagination, I find this in my own life, that I was locked up, that colonization of the Guyanas, the Caribbean, Africa, parts of Asia, etc., even in America, you are locked in a cell. The jailer could even give you the key, you wouldn't come out, because you couldn't find your way. You couldn't even operate outside of a cell. The black psyche has been so tremendously damaged that even if you were to give certain black people a key and says, okay, now, walk out, they wouldn't walk out. Even if they walk out, they would carry the prison like an overcoat with them. Okay, the liberation of the imagination is something more serious than merely protesting, oh, I've been a slave, oh, you have maltreated me, oh, this and that. It also involves a serious attempt to reconstruct the self so that freedom doesn't just become an absurdity, because freedom can become a mockery. You find this in parts of Africa, where you would give certain Africans the keys. And he says, all right, there's no prison anymore. You do your thing. And he is going to do exactly the same thing the European did. He is going to end up locking himself up or locking his people up. Okay, because you see, change, real serious change, does not merely involve in giving the man the key. He has to find a way out of the cell. Walking out of a cell doesn't mean you're walking out of prison. You can carry the prison with you in your head. Okay, you find this, I don't want to call names, you can find this among some Africans who have to be still to be liberated. So that even though they may have power or an apparent, a shadow of power, they don't have the substance of power. Because you can have the shadow of power without the substance. The substance involves a real freedom within, where you can start to rethink your country, rethink your philosophy, rethink the way you can carry your country in a certain direction. You don't just mimic the imperialist who has already messed up the world. You begin to retread your steps. That is why these studies are so important. Without these kinds of historical studies, which make you realize there is an alternative vision, there's an alternative human being, there's an alternative way of sensing, feeling, thinking, you cannot escape that cell, because you are greatly impoverished by the bankrupt philosophy of those people who have colonized you. And you just go on mimicking them, so that even when you seem to be free of them, all that has been withdrawn from you is their constant, intimate presence as a jailer. But they're still inside your head, merely continuing their colonization. This is what one means by the colonization of the imagination. That you are still a colony, even when the yoke of the colony has been lifted, you remain a colony. Your thinking, your feeling, your vision has been colonized.
Or do you find that people approach you and say, well, what can I do? I'm interested in biology, I'm interested in anthropology, I'm interested in
well, it
whatever.
Takes time. I think a school will eventually emerge, a school of scholars who will pursue independently or as a community various aspects of this, or various implications of this. But I think at the beginning, the ability to integrate all of these elements is not easy. And part of it comes as a result of accidents of one's personality. Because for me, I could not survive anymore unless I could find an alternative vision. I was so utterly oppressed and humiliated by the imperialist vision that I had canceled out myself. You know, I had literally canceled out my personality, so that the need to find a thread in history that could be truly meaningful and true, not just some mythical world, something that one could really attach oneself to and explore. It's like finding a golden mine, finding a vein, okay? And people have to find this in various ways. One's task, one's mission, as I see it, is to open people's consciousness. And with that new consciousness, they will do their own thing. They will find their own way to various aspects of this, either as scholarship or as in terms of their own life, their own new way of feeling and thinking and seeing.
You've been listening to Ivan Van Sertima, interviewed by Barry Scott and Paris Williams.
A man without knowledge of himself and his heritage is like a tree without roots. Dick Gregory.
I believe in those and loyalty.